Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, hosted by author Michael DeCamp and his family. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch studios, this podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll find interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, and performers, as well as friendly banter about any number of topics. Turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, and, Mike.
Well, hi. Hi, Nancy. She just jumps right in there. Welcome back to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm your host, Mike DeCamp, and I'm here with Jump In
Cutoff. Nancy DeCamp.
Yeah, there you go. Nancy.
World's best interrupter.
She's quite skilled at it. So that's our co-host, Nancy DeCamp. And we have a special guest today.
Yes, we do.
Sherry Stewart. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing great. Thank you for being on the podcast this time around.
Yes, we look forward to talking to you a little bit more about your creative pursuits. And
yeah, and I'm actually, I'm excited to have Sherry on because Sherry has become my go-to editor for my publishing for the books that I've written. I think of the five books that I have published, I think three of them Sherry has edited and the other two should have been.
Well, I really enjoy editing your books because they're really fun to read.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Anytime you want to give me a compliment during this podcast, you just feel free to go right ahead.
I'll go for it.
So we're going to open up with our creative indulgences for this episode. And Nancy, what's your creative indulgence this time around?
So my creative indulgence this time around, Sherry, I had an podcasters or people who listen here have heard this more than once, but in September I had the opportunity to go to Scotland. And since coming back, you know, I'll look up things on social media. So the algorithms have hit to show a lot of, you know, beautiful Scottish scenery pops up on my social media feed and all this. But
yeah, she's constantly like, hey, you can do this in Scotland or you can see this in Scotland. Oh, you can go there in Scotland. I'm like, when am I going to go? I haven't gone.
My focus for my creative indulgence has been, there was a particular bar in the town of Inverness called McGregor's, and they have Facebook page, and most Fridays they call it Live at Five and they're playing live Scottish music. So it's noon East Coast time, US. And then that's led me to my real indulgences that one of the owners of the bar, Bruce McGregor, and then one of the musicians that's there quite a bit, Anna Massey, are part of a group called Blazing, B-L-A-Z-I-N, Fiddles, Blazing Fiddles. So they are a contemporary Scottish folk group. And there are several violinists or fiddlers, and then they'll have a guitar and a keyboard or what have you. And I have become obsessed. I've purchased some of their music on from my, you know, iTunes, Apple Tunes, you know, and I'm loving it. And the ties, I don't tend to like country music. I like some country songs, but the genre itself, I don't care for, but I love bluegrass. And there are so many ties and similarities to some of the Scottish folk music, to that kind of like Appalachian bluegrass. And I've just probably more than everything Scottish, I have just become obsessed. And my creative indulgence has been Blazing Fiddles. So if any of you are have a music interest, go out and check them out.
The Blazing Fiddles.
Blazing Fiddles.
Blazing Fiddles. I'm just thinking Blazing Saddles.
I know, right?
But no fiddles. I can see how they came up with the name.
Yeah, yeah.
My husband's parents were from Scotland, so he would have been really...
I definitely
excited to hear about that.
I definitely had a wonderful experience and fell in love with many aspects of the culture, the terrain, and just the trip itself was awesome. But I tend to lean towards music. I really like a lot of music, just all different kinds. And so that's what's been my creative indulgence most recently.
Sherry, what's yours? What's your creative indulgence?
I like to eat.
That is a good thing.
And I also like to cook, and I like new cookbooks. So whenever I buy a cookbook, I have to try every recipe in it from front cover to back cover.
Every single one?
in order.
Oh, wow.
And then, and I mean, there are some things like I just can't eat. I'm not big on tripe or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will try to work my way. I call it working my way through a cookbook. I also do the same thing in restaurants. I work my way through menus.
Okay.
So that I have to get the next thing on the list, even if I don't really want it.
Interesting. So that's a very creative approach to.
I would say that's a little OCD, but that's what I am.
But it's methodical in how you get through it all, right?
What's your most unusual thing that you've tried recently, either in a restaurant or from a cookbook?
Probably oysters, Rockefeller. I'm not a big oysters eater.
Yeah, I don't do oysters.
And I didn't really love it. So, no.
Yeah.
That was probably the most unusual.
Now, when we were when we were talking before we got started, you said you had more than one.
Oh, I have a lot of interests, a lot of crazy interests. When I write a book, my favorite part about writing a book is going to wherever it is and and doing the whole book. Like if they're looking in a window, I'm looking in a window. If they, you know, eat a certain thing, I eat a certain thing. The book I'm writing right now, goes to Zurich. So that's where I'm going in September.
Oh, nice.
And I'm looking forward to that. And so, I watch a lot of YouTube videos on Zurich, know, and I walk the streets and I'm all ready for it right now. So I can't wait for that.
That does sound exciting.
Earlier this year, I wrote a book, that took place in Maine. Bar Harbor. So we went up to Maine, but we did it in February when it's cheap because
it can be pricey.
Bar Harbor is really expensive apparently, but when you do it in February, nobody's there. Most of the restaurants are closed.
Uh-huh.
Everything is like half price. So you don't really get a feel for the way it is, but we really liked it. And so that was a trip. And then September, this past September, we did, I wrote, part of my book took place in Lancaster in a town called Bird in Hand in Pennsylvania. So we went to Bird in Hand and did the whole thing there. So that was fun.
Oh, that's cool.
That is a fun way to approach.
I think it's a guilty pleasure of mine, an expensive pleasure of mine.
Yeah. Travel is always worth it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, Nancy and I went to Bar Harbor.
Yes, we just went last year to Bar Harbor in Acadia. Yeah.
We were in the summer, though. Well,
yeah, we went in August.
August, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we went in August. It was hot. It was humid.
Yeah, but it was a really wonderful trip.
Yeah.
And we stayed in a bed and breakfast not far from the downtown. We were walking distance to everything. And we figured out that during the season there, you can park your car at wherever you're staying. And then you can walk and catch buses everywhere.
Yeah, the national park will take you all over. The bus will take you all over the entire island for free.
Not in the winter.
Yeah.
Nope.
It's only during in season. But that we stumbled across that. And I was like, that was a really nice thing to stumble across because then there was one time we actually rode the bus all the way across the island.
Yeah.
To another
little town.
Yeah.
So,
what about your creative indulgence?
My creative indulgence right now is we just came back from a vacation in Florida. We were in Sarasota.
I love Sarasota.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Sarasota is a I shouldn't say great little city. It's a medium sized city, but it's a great little place to stay right on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got to town, I think one of the first things we did, we grabbed some breakfast and I think we walked around a little bit. Didn't we end up in the bookstore that first day or was it? Yeah, it was the first day.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we went into a Barnes & Noble.
That's an indulgence for sure.
Yeah. You know, being an author myself, Sherry, you know, one of the things I do once in a while is kind of I have this obnoxious streak.
He does.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an obnoxious streak. I walk up to one of the people working there walked up and asked if there was anything they could help me find. And so I said, well, do you have any books by Michael DeCamp?
You're going to say that.
And then she goes, well.
And then you said you should.
And she said, I can go look. I said, don't waste your time. I'm just messing with you. I'm actually Michael DeCamp. And yes, I am an author, but you know, my books will be in your your catalog you can order from, but you're probably not going to have them on the shelf. But I did go and find of two of my local author friends. I did find their books on their shelf.
That was fun.
So Angela Jackson Brown and Francesca Zappia were both on their shelf there. So that was pretty cool.
We know them.
But while I was there, I picked up a book by Stephen King, and I haven't read a Stephen King book in a long time, mostly because he gets a little gross once in a while.
He does.
And
which one did you have?
It's a brand new one. It's called Fairy Tale. And it's basically about a young boy. I shouldn't say young. He's a teenager. He's about 18. He saves the life of an old man that's near his home. But the old man has some secrets, and he ends up inheriting the property from the man and starts to uncover the secrets. The secrets basically are a portal to a whole nother world, kind of a fairy tale world. I can't really get.
You're the portal man.
Yeah, I am the portal man. I do write portal stories. I'm just getting to the part where he's exploring the portal. I'm about a little past third of the way in, and he's getting down to the portal portion. So that's going to be exciting to see where Stephen King takes it. One of my big complaints with Stephen is it seems like he doesn't know how to finish his story well, at least in my inexperienced and lack of being a super writer knowledge. I just feel like he could finish some of them better. And I'm hoping this one breaks that pattern, and he does really, really closes it out well.
It's very hard to finish books. Most authors don't do it very well because we're so eager to finish.
Yeah, we just want to get finished. Now, I will say this. Nancy here is not a super fan of my stories, Sherry. Believe it or not, she's not a super fan of my stories. They're not her thing.
I think they're written well. They're edited very well. But they're just not my type of story.
But she did tell me that this last one, Reckless Abandon, she thought I finished it very well.
Yeah. I thought it came together well.
So
it did. Good. It did.
So
speaking of Bar Harbor, I went to Stephen King's house while I was there.
We did too.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, we got pictures in front of the big iron gate with the bats and the spiders. So that was pretty cool.
That's fun. So Mike, how do you know Sherry?
How do I know Sherry? Mm-hmm. I know Sherry because she was recommended to me. I'd finished my first novel, was working on the second one, and I think I asked our mutual publisher, Cynthia, if she knew who I could go to for some editing, some professional editing. And
somebody with a serious red pen.
Yeah, somebody who could really, really help me with the story. And so, because my process is I write the story, I edit it. I'll try that again in actual words. I edit it two or three times myself. And then I send it out to beta readers, let them give me feedback. And then after I've done all that, I send it to Sherry. The first one did not get that.
It
didn't get the Sherry touch. And so it probably could use it, but at this point I don't really want to touch it. But I sent the second book. I don't know if I sent was it Nozomi's Battle I sent you first, or was it the short stories? Do you remember, Sherry?
I think I got the short stories first. I can't remember, but I know I've done short stories and Nozomi. So
yeah.
I do like the short stories.
I don't know
stories.
In which order.
Yeah. So Cynthia Hickey, who is our publisher, and she's also an accomplished New York Times bestseller writer, she recommended Sherry to be my editor. And so I reached out to her and she said, sure, I'll give it a go. Awesome. And
so Sherry, do you edit a lot, or you just because of your writing background or other background, how did you get into doing anything?
I edit a lot. I spend about 6 days a week editing. I usually am working on at least 1 to 3 books at any time.
Okay.
And I really can't handle more than 3. At a time.
But, I would think they would start meshing together some.
I'm at it. It's pretty much, if I didn't you know, set Sunday aside, I'd be editing every day of the week.
Yeah.
Because most of my authors need their books for, you know, to meet deadlines. So, yeah. So I know, like right now I'm editing one. Since COVID, it's really weird. It seems like people are, they're not as, what shall I say, deadline oriented. Like, let's say they'll say, I'd like you to edit my book in the middle of March. And then it won't come in for like 3 weeks after that. Because they'll just have forgotten. And they'll say, oh, COVID fog or something like that. I don't know. But it just seems so. I can't, you know, like right now I'm supposed to be editing three books. And two of them said, well, I can't do it right now. So, you know, so I have another book. So I don't know when those other two are going to show up, but they will.
Right.
And I have another one starting in the middle of the month. And I have a couple starting at the end of the month. So
kind of hard
to
balance.
Who knows how it all works out. It's just kind of crazy. Now I can't really go with a schedule.
Right.
You know, the last deadline I had was for Reckless Abandon, my last novel. And I missed it by a year.
The deadline, you missed the deadline by a year.
But Cynthia did not give me a hard time, which I'm very much appreciated. But we got her done. How did you get into editing? You're also an author. I was looking at your author page on Amazon. You've got many, many books out. Which came first, the authoring or the authoring? Is that an actual word? The writing or the editing? Which came first?
Writing for sure. I wrote my first book in about 2012, I want to say. I had been practicing law, and I worked for a firm that we just kind of dropped the ball in a couple cases, and it always bothered me. So I thought, I'm going to write a legal suspense book. And try to solve those cases, like do them right this time
or
get them done right. So that's how my first book came.
What's the title of that book?
Come Out of Hiding.
Okay.
So it really is about two of the cases that I was working on at the time. And then there's a sequel to that called A Well-Founded Fear of Death. And that also is about a case or two that I worked on. I assumed I would know how to write because I taught English for many years and I'd written tons and tons of essays for law school. But I didn't know how to write a fiction. Fiction is completely different than any kind of writing. Yeah. So I could never have edited it before I wrote books. So what I did is with my first book, I found a writer's group in my community at the time, and it was really harsh. I was just there as an observer to start, but the way they picked at each other, I thought, wow, I could never do that. I don't have enough of an ego to handle that. So I thought, well, maybe I need to go to a Christian editing group. Maybe that will be better. So I just kind of Googled it, and I found a group called Word Weavers. In the Orlando area. It was quite a drive from where I live. It meets once a month on a Saturday. So I started going there and I learned so much from Word Weavers. And pretty much everything that I put into your books when I edit them is stuff that I learned. I knew grammar, I knew punctuation and spelling, but that's not editing fiction. Mm-hmm. Editing fiction, you need to know about point of view. You need to know about show v tell. You need to know about filtered speech and how to write dialogue and how to do pace and
passive.
You know,
writing
there's also many things you have to look at.
Yeah,
you don't learn that in college. You don't learn that in the classroom. You learn that from other writers.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I learned about writing books, and then I couldn't get my book. That book I wrote, I think in 2012, I think, or 2011, I can't remember. But I didn't get it published till 2015. And Cynthia's great because she gives us all kinds of chances to write books. And we get a lot of experience writing.
Mm-hmm. Are, Are all of your books that you have published, are they all published through Cynthia's Winged?
All but one. A book called A Song for Enemies was picked up by a different publishing company.
Oh, nice.
And that came out in 2021.
Lot of reviews on Amazon on that one, I think. I think it's like 90 reviews and a lot of stars. So, yeah, very well.
Yeah, that book. Have you ever heard of Corrie Ten Boom?
Yes.
Okay, so basically it's based on the story of Corrie Ten Boom. It's not Corrie Ten Boom, but it's based on her story about somebody that hides from Jews during the Holocaust.
Wow.
In Holland, in the Netherlands. This book here, called What Hides Behind the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
This one is the sequel to it, but Cynthia did this one.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So she published that one.
This is the one that just got the finalist award for the CLO Awards.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So when do the actual prizes get awarded for that?
I don't know. I think August. Maybe August.
Okay. Well, good luck. I hope you win that. That'd be really exciting.
There's no way I could win it.
Well, you're a finalist.
This is one of those. I'm just happy to be a finalist.
Yeah, that's great recognition for your efforts and your work.
That's good enough for me.
You know, it's funny that you say you talk about the different ways that you learn things in writing. And I can remember in college, I learned more about grammar in a business writing course than I ever did in English class that I took. The instructor's fault. It was most likely me, but it made sense and it made connection when I took that business writing course. But the fact of you finding a group of people that you learned from, you know, that whole network and sharing and that type of thing. How many people, I'd be curious to know, Mike, how many people study to become a writer and become a writer, like the percentage versus.
I would say probably most of the ones who study to become a writer don't end up becoming a writer. And I don't know that for sure, but I would think that's probably the case. And there's lots of people who never studied to become a writer, who try to become a writer and still don't become writers.
But then there's people who do, like when we talked to Francesca, you know, as a child, she was writing.
Yeah, she was 10 years old and she was writing a novel.
Yeah.
So she's pretty amazing, by the way. If you haven't seen any of Francesca Zappia's work, she's young adult. She's not afraid to use the four-letter words. So I will say that she writes some pretty interesting stories. I'll just put it at that. It's kind of young adult, but it's a young adult fantasy kind of thriller stuff. So
what would you say was the main, you know, maybe top two things that you learned when you first embarked on writing a book that made a difference for you to.
One thing is to develop the ability to take criticism.
Yeah,
that's the main one. Mm-hmm. Because when you go to these meetings, well, you know what it's like. Because mm-hmm. when I edit your book,
yeah,
I mean, I try to be gentle, but I'm really touching your baby. I mean, I'm not touching your baby. What do I mean? I'm criticizing your baby.
Yeah,
saying you need to improve this and this and this and this. You know, and it's hard because you put your heart and soul into this book and somebody's criticizing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta have a little bit thicker skin. If you're going to do it right. I mean, if you just want to throw it out there, you do it without getting any criticism, but if you want to do it right, you've got to be able to take some criticism, right?
Right. Yeah. And you're going to get reviews that aren't good.
Mm-hmm.
They're good reviews. They just don't, you know, they didn't like your book the way you want them to like the book.
Yeah. So, luckily for us, like we joke about me not liking Mike's story. He knew when he wrote it.
I knew she wouldn't.
He's like, she's not going to like this story. Yeah. But
I had one person that on Goodreads, she said that she stopped reading it because it was too weird. And I'm like, oh, that's actually, I like that review.
That's actually a compliment for you, huh?
Yeah, thank you for saying that.
So was there anything else that was pivotal for you? Do you feel like?
I think just learning the conventions of fiction that I hadn't known about, that isn't taught in school. And I thought I knew it. I mean, I taught 12th grade English at one time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know a lot of the things that I've learned since then after, you know, taking courses or going to my writers groups or going to conferences and, you know, attending classes.
Yeah.
I've just learned a lot about the art of writing and what it takes to write a novel. Yeah.
Well, and I'll ask this because I've learned this through Mike and some other author friends that we've talked to or he's introduced me to. So do you plan your novels, your books out, or are you what do they call a pantser who just...
I'm a pantser. I might be a planter, but I'm definitely a pantser. I have a general idea where usually I go for walks every day. I walk a lot at Disney. I'll go to the parks, walk it, and then go right back to my car. It's not like I do anything while I'm there, but yeah. It's a very pleasant milieu to walk in.
Sure.
Waterfall sounds and birds and all that. But as I'm walking, I'm plotting and I'm thinking, okay, I need to do this. I'm going to write this and this and this and this. But when I write a book, I vomit the words out. That's what I like to call it. I'm just vomiting the words out. And that's what a pantser does. It's like, if I stop and reread it or try to edit it or something, I'd never finish a book. Mm-hmm. I just have to write the whole thing. And I'm just always amazed how God takes me in different directions than I had thought. Like I'll be writing along and then he'll just take me in a direction I hadn't thought in the book. I thought, whoa, that's really cool.
That's funny that you say that because we talked to somebody a few months ago and he's like, yeah, I never know what my characters are going to do. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're writing them.
You're writing them, but you're also sort of watching them. You know, that's the interesting thing for me, at least for me, I'm a pantser too, Sherry. It's kind of like I'm watching this story unfold in my head and I'm just writing it down. And so, you don't always know when you pants, you don't always know what your character's going to do next.
Yeah. So, have you ever heard of Stephen James?
Hmm.
He writes, thrillers.
Okay.
And I attended a workshop in Tampa where he was speaking, and he said two things to me that were really cool. And this is what I kind of use when you get that thing, like, I don't know what, you know, that feeling when you say, I don't know where I should go next.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So what he says is, and you do two things. You write what you ask yourself this question. What would be the next thing that should reasonably happen?
Mm-hmm.
And write that. And then the next question you ask yourself is, and what will be the next thing that will knock your reader's socks off? And you write that. And then you just kind of go back and forth between the two. What should reasonably happen? What would knock the socks off of the reader?
Yeah.
And it kind of helps you.
Yeah. That sounds like fun.
I could see that being a fun approach for sure.
So I was reading through your bio and it says you taught for a long time. You said you taught 12th grade English, right? But you were also a flight attendant for a while and you were on the California bar. That just seems like an interesting career path. So now you write books and editing. So can you kind of take us through that a little bit? How did that transition all kind of occur?
It's because of my husband. It's all his fault. he was with a hockey team. He passed away a couple of years ago, but when he was alive, he was with an NHL hockey team, and we would. He was on the road all the time. And I think he just wanted, you know, so I had to have my hobbies to keep me busy while he was gone.
Sure.
And And I've always, for example, there was the time when I was taking piano lessons. Okay, that went, that lasted for a while. I'd always wanted to be a flight attendant because I love travel. And I was a French major in college. I wanted to do that. And I was hired by Delta. Then my husband's hockey team, which was in Atlanta, it was called the Atlanta Flames, was sold and moved to Calgary, Alberta, which is really far away.
Yes, it is.
And so I had to decide, am I going to give up my career or is he going to give up his career? Because my job, it was a really good job at that point. I really loved it. So I really had to pray about it. Mm. And God told me, you're going to have to, it's his turn this time. So that I gave it up. And we moved to Alberta. He's now on the road. I'm living in the northwest mountains, right by the Rocky Mountains. But I just, so I started teaching again, because that's kind of what I have a degree in, and that's what I could do. And then later on, I became a principal of the school. And then we moved back to the States in 1999. We moved back to Atlanta when they put another hockey team in. But I always wanted to go to law school. So, and I started that when my son graduated from high school and my house was very empty. And I was sitting there playing video games and thinking, I need to do something with my life here because this is not good. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started going to law school. I didn't care if I ever became a lawyer. I just wanted to go to law school because I just loved it. I mean, learning about crime and learning about all this cool stuff. Yeah. So that's how I became a lawyer. And California bar, my law school was in California, so I had to take the California bar. So that's how that went.
Okay.
Yep.
Very interesting. So we know you said your first couple of books were based on cases that you were familiar with that gave you that storyline so you could solve them. What motivates you, or what's your muse, or what inspires the creativity now as you write books?
Oh, that's a hard question. The book I'm writing right now has been a story that I've had in my mind for maybe 15 years, way before I started writing books. It's a story that is controversial, and it probably won't be accepted very well by a lot of people. And I found out that it was kind of already written by somebody called Francine Rivers, and it was called The Atonement Child.
Okay. Mm.
So I thought, well, maybe, so I just kind of put it on the back burner. Of course, there can be a lot of books about the same subject.
Yes, yes.
Not sure. Like I'm going to copy her book or anything. I have my own ideas. So I thought, well, this is going to be my next book. And that's what I'm writing right now. And it's going to be about a girl, an anchor, a news anchor, who's being stalked by an obsessive fan. Mm. And then it goes into being attacked by him. Mm. Yeah.
Would you say that having deadlines or boundaries encourages your creativity in your stories and your thought processes, or leaving it open fosters some of those creative processes?
Good question. I have my own internal pattern. Like I write 500 words a day, 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. And so I can figure out what the length of a book is going to be. And then from there, know when I have to finish it. And I don't sign up or take on a book contract or anything unless I know I can finish it. My last book that just came out a few weeks ago, I almost missed my deadline because there wasn't a real solid deadline on it. And I just was editing so much that it was hard for me to get in to write every day. And then Cynthia says, I need it now. So I hadn't edited it the way, like I have, I use the same process you do. I have beta readers and then I send my book to be edited by a professional. Because I can't edit my own books.
I was going to ask you, did you ever edit your own books?
Yeah. Well, because she said I need it right now, I tried to edit my own book. Mm. And it didn't work. I thought it worked. I turned it in. And what I always do whenever I write a book, I don't know if you do this or not, but I do this. After it becomes a Kindle book, I buy it, but I don't tell anybody it's out. And then I go through it and I look for all the mistakes because there always are some.
Right, right.
Always are some. And so I fix a mistake. So I have Cynthia send me back my book. I fix the mistakes. And once, you know, it's fixed, then I tell people that the book is out there.
Oh, okay.
Well, I did it this time. And then when it got into, it became a paperback, which was just a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine said, there are some mistakes in that book. Mm. So I got out my paperback copy of it and I couldn't believe all the mistakes there were. I had missed them reading it in the Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
And how did I do that?
Because your mind already knew what it was supposed to be.
You're so familiar.
Yeah, so you read right over it and your mind made it what you knew it was supposed to be, even though that's not what it was. And that's, I think that's why
do you do that,
have,
Mike?
Every writer does that. That's why you have to have someone else with skills do your editing because your brain already knows what's supposed to be there and it will just put it there as you're reading it. And so you have to have someone with a fresh view of it, look at it, who can edit it for you. Now I can catch a lot of things myself, but I can't catch everything myself. I do kind of edit on the, as I'm going, but well, take for example, you know, the first book that I wrote, Abandoned Hope, the one you did not get to edit that I wish I'd let you edit but I didn't know you then. When I sent it off to the beta readers, it went to about 12 different ones. I don't use that many now, but I had 12 or 13 beta readers. And one of them was a retired English teacher. And this retired English, I thought it was perfect when I sent it out. I thought I had fixed every conceivable thing. And it came back from her with red ink on every single page. And she got it from her brother. And I was friends on Facebook with her brother, so I could see what she would comment. And she said something about, he really doesn't know how to use ellipses, does he? You know, something like that.
Yeah.
She was making comments about it, which were accurate. I didn't even know what they were called. So right. It was, I use the beta readers for concepts and
continuity.
Yeah. And you know, if they find some things that are grammar, that's great. And I'll fix as much as everything I can before I send it to you, Sherry. And then you do your magic. And then I go through and I probably accept about 90% of what you kick back to me. And the stuff that I don't is more about opinion than I think it is about, you know, what has to be fixed. One of them that you kicked back to me this last time, I was perplexed because in Reckless Abandon, I introduced a character who is African-American and I had mentioned his skin color and you kicked it back and we're saying that basically that's not accepted anymore to talk about skin color in fiction. And so I was like, well, how am I going to actually describe who this person is and not talk about that? And so I reached out to my friend Angela Jackson Brown and asked her opinion because she's African-American. She writes some awesome books. And so she gave me some feedback and then I went in and I took your feedback. I took Angela's feedback and I tweaked it and tried to fix it so that I didn't blatantly use those terms. but still was able to describe who this person was.
Well, it's good to go to a reliable source in something like that. I think especially, Sherry, as you talk about going and visiting cities or locations where you're writing a story, gives a genuine authenticity to what you're saying, right?
Right. Well, I hope so. And plus it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
But you're right. This whole race thing came up in our Word Weavers meeting. We have an African-American, one of the leaders, and that's kind of her area of expertise. And she just gave us all these rules. She said, this is what publishers don't want. And they're not going to touch it if it has skin color. If you use a food to describe skin color, you know, whatever, think about what it could be.
Peaches and cream complexion or something or like that. Yeah, yeah.
Chocolate or hazelnut. I don't know.
Any.
If you use language, some kind of a grammatical thing, not allowed to do that. If you make them the bad guy, there was another one. These are all things we have to, that we were told publishers do not want to see in our society that we have right now, where it's not a lot of give and take right now. So, it's a very sensitive site. Now, I don't know how long this is going to last. Is this just a temporary thing? I don't even know if it's still going on, but this is the way it was when I edited your book.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have an awareness. It's hard in all the circumstances, but it's good to have an awareness. Mm-hmm. What are the social mores, or, you know, what is most appropriate or most kind, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's good.
Right.
There's an awareness. I think perspective and awareness can only help in any scenario, whether you choose to follow it or not is your choice. But having that awareness, I would think, be helpful.
Right.
Sherry, I've got a new book I'm working on. It's going to come your way probably this summer.
He's been writing like crazy.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. I look forward to it.
How long does it take? You say you write 500 words a day?
Yeah.
How long does that take you?
Maybe an hour and a half.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably that.
I'm probably putting in not much. I was doing it every day, but probably only putting in about 20 minutes because that's all I could fit into my little gap before I had to start my regular day job. But then lately my dog.
His dog. You need to dedicate the next book to the dog.
Yeah, this book will be dedicated to Leo, the Australian Shepherd. Because he
wakes him up. I sleep through it, but he wakes Mike up really early.
Yeah. See, I typically, for years, I've gotten up at 6 a.m., Sherry, and Leo's been getting me up anywhere from 4:30 to 5:15 every day. Every single day. And most of the time it's like 4:40, 4:43. So then I'm up. And so if it's before 5, I'll take him out and then I'll kick back in my chair for a little bit and try to catch a few more winks. But then I've just decided, I'm going to write at 5 a.m. And
now he's going to bed earlier. So he is actually getting good night's sleep.
Yeah, I'm going to bed earlier to compensate. But it's
quieter and more able to focus, you think, during that time frame?
I don't know if it's really about that. It's just that I'm doing it. And so I'm sitting there at 6:10 and I start writing, and I write all the way up until, well, not 6:10, 5:10. And I write all the way up to 6.
Yeah.
So I'm probably getting somewhere between 600 and 800 words in that time period. What's your word count typically on your books, Sherry, when you're writing?
Depends on the type of book. This book here is about 94,000 words.
Okay.
The last book I wrote was about 55,000.
Okay.
It just depends. For a while, Cynthia was really wanting us to write novellas. You know what novellas are? Yeah, they're like 25 to 30,000 words. They have
less than 200 pages or something like that, aren't they?
Oh, they're small. I have a whole bunch, and I've written a lot of them.
Yeah.
I just don't like writing that short of a book anymore. Because there's you can do one story. You can't have a multiple stories and plots going on. You know, that's what your books have, a lot of plots going on.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of different characters that are doing different things. You can't do that in a 30,000 word book. But I have written a lot of those. It was like Cynthia would say, okay, we're going to do a collection on Route 66. Each of you take a different state. It was kind of fun. Oh, you know? So you had your little book that you had to write. I did mine on Illinois. and then we went there. We went to see this, you know, the Route 66 museum in Pontiac, Illinois. That was one of our trips. But that's what she did, and it was fun. I don't think she's doing that so much anymore.
That's a very creative approach.
I learned how to write books doing those little books. Yeah. I mean, it really kind of, I honed my skills that way.
Are you a reader?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I read. Well, I'm reading, editing books all day long. Yeah. I read before I go to sleep at night. I listen to a novel in the car.
What's your favorite?
I'm listening to one now called The Maid.
Yes.
It is. A lot of people, you know it?
I know it. Yes.
Okay, because a lot of people don't like it, but I like it a lot.
You know, it really does give you perspective on life.
Yeah.
You know.
I believe this girl is, she has Asperger's syndrome. And she can't, she's a maid.
Yeah.
In a hotel. And she can't tell, she doesn't know how to read people like sarcasm. Mm-hmm. So whatever they say, she does and believes.
Yeah.
And so she's very naive and people take advantage of her all the time. And she sees a murder and she doesn't even know how to handle the interrogation because, you know, when you're interrogated, they're trying to get you to tell the truth and they're in, and she can't read them because she doesn't read anything but what people say.
Yeah.
So it's really quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite genre to read?
That's a hard one. I think I like World War II fiction, historical fiction.
Are the stories that you write, are they mostly historical fiction or
my longer books tend to be historical fiction. I think they have the most substance. Mm-hmm. But right now I'm writing a romantic suspense. I don't even know if it's going to be romantic. I think it's just going to be suspense.
Well, have them kiss somebody and then you can throw a romantic in there.
Put that tag on it.
Well, you know, there is a recipe or a pattern that you have to follow when you write romance.
I've heard that.
Like you have to, like the man and the girl have to meet each other in the first chapter.
Oh, really?
Okay. It's like a whole template.
And the very last chapter, they either have to get married or they have to be committing to one another in some way. And then there's lots of back and forth and, you know, breaking up and not understanding each other throughout the book. But it has to have those features.
Do all genres have that kind of a template or is it just that's the romance? Because I know that's a big, big publishing area.
You know what's really big right now is Regency. And Regency.
Isn't that funny? Regency romance.
A tighter requirement list. I've never edited a Regency book before, but I had somebody contact me a couple of weeks ago and say, do you do Regency? And I say, I don't mind trying it, but I've never done it before. And they didn't call me back because they wanted somebody that specific, knew the whole way to do it. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Have you had any of your books narrated? Audiobooks?
I did. I did an audio book. Can't remember the name of the company that did it. I think it was something like Axis or something like that. They did one of my books. Yeah.
Okay. I'm about to release Abandoned Hope in an audio book. I actually got a voice actor from California who's done the narration. I believe he's done with every chapter. Now we got to do the opening, kind of the introduction stuff. And then I'll be uploading it and getting it on the market That was kind of a fun process.
Tremendous.
Yeah. And it's funny for the podcast listeners who have heard this before, we tease Mike because he was out, you were Googling his own name, right?
Yeah.
And came across some different people, but there was an actor named Michael DeCamp.
Oh.
Yes. And so I ended up, after a period of years of kind of just keeping track of him, he posted a picture on Instagram, him with a microphone, hashtag voice actor. And so I sent him, I just commented on it. I just said, hey, here's a cool idea. You could narrate my books and then they'll be written by Michael DeCamp and narrated by Michael DeCamp. And he just thought he actually responded, thought that was funny, and kind of interesting. And we ended up connecting, exchanged phone numbers. And
you met him. You were on a business trip for your day job and met him in California.
Met him in California. He lives in Glendale. So. And so he actually decided he wanted to narrate Abandoned Hope. And so it's going to be written by Michael DeCamp and narrated by Michael DeCamp. It's kind of funny. But I'm thinking about, there's some of my stuff I'm thinking about narrating myself because I've got the equipment. And so yes. I'm thinking about, I've
that's
got
a big part of it.
Yeah, I have a nonfiction book that I did not have you edit and probably should have. And then I have my short stories. And so I thought I might narrate those. And I thought I could maybe do that and just get the flavor for it.
I feel like we interrupted you. You were going to say, what was your experience? Or do you like having your book in an audio book, the one that you had done? Or what do you think about the audio?
I have mixed feelings about it now. I love. I wasn't really satisfied with the voice of the person that read it.
Mm-hmm.
I chose them too because the people auditioned.
Oh, very cool. Them,
right. But it just was the sound of the voice came out very jaded.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't what I wanted in terms of the tone of the book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
So we're getting down to where we're at about 52 minutes into this, into the podcast. We typically go about an hour. So, let me ask you this, share with the audience where they can find your books and what, you know, give them some idea of which ones that you think that they should start with. Things like that. What would you like to say about your books and where they can find them and where they can find out more about Sherry Stewart?
All right. Well, my books are on Amazon, and I would start with A Song for Her Enemies, which is a book about World War II, if you like history. And then follow it with this book that is the sequel called What Hides Behind the Walls. It's the same characters. A lot of people seem to like it.
Okay.
So try those two books. I have a book called Dear Eyes that I wrote. That's my Bar Harbor book. And I wrote that from a guy's point of view. That's the first time I've written a book from a guy's point of view. So I'd be interested in hearing people's opinions on that.
You know, we've had that discussion before about whether a male, how effective they are in writing from a woman's point of view and really vice versa. I think that's an interesting consideration. What, Mike, do you have an opinion on the subject?
I think that a good author needs to be able to write from both perspectives.
Yeah.
But I think they should be really careful about writing from the opposite gender's perspective. They need to make sure they really understand what they're talking about and not just trying to write a woman's view from a man's perspective, because that'll be picked up on pretty quick, I think.
Well, it kind of gets back to a little bit what you said about like some parameters culturally, and maybe it's not a cultural thing, men and women, but there is an awareness that I guess that you would have speaking from a point of view, any point of view, whether it's male, female, or, you know.
If you write like a book like the ones I write, I've got so many different characters. I'm writing from their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So, you know, each one of them, there's some male and there's some female, and I've had to kind of infuse, you know, that point of view on that character. I tried to fit that character, not so much make them, make them sound like a boy or make them sound like a girl. It was
right.
So it is about the character. Sherry, have you read the Poisonwood Bible by King Solver?
No, I haven't.
That's when you talk about speaking from different perspectives. That's one of my most favorite books because she develops the character so much that each chapter is a different character's perspective, but you don't know that. But as the book goes along, you know exactly which daughter or it's the wife or it's who it is, perspective it is because of how it is written. And I find that very interesting. So when you start talking about characters and coming from a different angle, I could see that being a very strong attribute if, as an author, you're able to write in a way that people automatically know, well, this is you know, Joe down the street, and this is Sally at the diner, and you know.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sherry.
I have written short parts of a book that were from a guy's point of view, but this was the whole book was from this guy's point of view. Wow. So what I did is I had guys read it as my beta readers.
Oh, good.
Because I said, you know, you need to tell me whether this sounds accurate or not, if this reads right. Yeah. And they said it did. So
good. Oh, if you do that one on an audio book, you'll need to do
lower your voice a bit.
Well, I won't read it. Maybe I'll get you to read it.
I might be game.
Have a new business.
I have kicked around putting a sound booth in my house. I actually have. I haven't convinced my wife that I should yet, but I'm working on her. Sherry, anything else? Where can people find out more about you?
I have a website called stuartwriting.com. I have a newsletter I put out a couple times a year, usually after I've gone on a trip. It's called Field Trip, and it has pictures from the different places we went, kind of five things you never knew about this place. I feature different writers in my newsletter, sometimes some recipes, that kind of thing. So that's called Field Trip. Cool. I'm on HHH, which is a blog. I think it's called Heroes, Heroines, and History.com, but we just call it HHH.com. It's a blog. Every day there's a different writer that's writing on something historical. Just kind of fun things. Where did a spoon come from? And where did some of the sayings we say come from? That kind of thing. So
that's good. That's good.
So 31 different writers. That's pretty much it. Stuartwriting.com. Yep.
Very cool. Well, we're about to jump into the random question and bring this to a close. So while she's doing that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book that I'm going to send to you for editing, hopefully this summer. So, you've read the other books. So you know how I've written those. This one's changing. I'm doing this one from first person. So first person's perspective. You know who the character Odd Thomas is from Dean Koontz?
I kind of remember that name. Yes.
Yeah. Look up Odd Thomas from Dean Koontz. He's a young, like fry cook from Southern California who can see, dead people, and he can see, other kind of spiritual entities and things, and, gets himself into some hot water. I'm sure you know who Jack Reacher is.
Yes.
So take Odd Thomas and smush him into Jack Reacher.
Okay.
And you've got the character.
That's the first person.
You've got the character I'm going to be writing writing. I'm about 20,000 words into the story. And he starts out in a little town in Indiana called Cutter's Notch. So that's his first stop. But he's going to end up in Florida. I don't know how many stories he's got, but he's supposed to be going to Sarasota, Florida. But he doesn't have any long-term memory. His memory only goes back 24 hours. And the only reason he knows. The only reason he knows anything about himself at all is whatever's in his journal. So he carries around a journal that he writes in. And so if he wants to know what happened last week, he has to go read his journal, to see what it was. And so this is I'm finding it a lot of fun to write him.
I I would love, you know, it takes a lot of skill to write a book from first person.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting. I like reading books from first person. They always tell you never write your first book. It takes some skill to do it. Mm-hmm. And nobody can really do it their first book, but you've been writing for a while, so I think you can handle it.
Very good. Nancy, you got the questions.
Yeah, I'm ready to put you on the hot seat now because you have to answer. You get to pick the question, but then you have to answer it first. So here
pick the question.
Yeah, I'm going to read three questions to you, and you can pick one. And the one you pick, you answer, and then Mike and I will have to give an answer to it as well.
Okay.
First question, is it okay to not leave a tip when you receive bad service? Second question, do you like talking to strangers on a plane? Third question, what is the least important subject in school? So bad service, talking on planes, and least important subject in school.
Hmm. This is up your alley in all three ways.
Tipping.
Okay. Is it okay to not leave a tip when you receive bad service?
I think it is okay to not leave a tip. I really think we need to tip these people because they, you know, are waiters and waitresses because, I mean, they are not paid a lot.
Right.
But I really prefer the way that Europe does it, where they pay their people enough.
They get an income. Yeah. They don't have to.
It's their income. So they do not take tips.
Right.
Unless you leave them, they'll take them, but they don't really.
Because so much here, their salary is like nothing. What they make is all in tips, right? In most places.
Right. That's right.
What do you think, Mike?
I absolutely think that if you've gotten really bad service, that you should not be obligated to leave them a tip. I think that's the motivation for them to do a great job. And so if you take away the opportunity for them to lose that motivation, then you're basically what, you know, let's just add it to the charge and not worry about a tip.
Yeah.
I think rarely have I ever not tipped. I think I might trim it a little bit if I think it was not the best.
Right.
But I think only maybe once or twice in my life have I not tipped at all.
Yeah.
And I think one of them was, I was on my way home from a business trip. I stopped for lunch. I was ready to go. I was done eating and the guy took like 15 minutes to come back and check on me and find out I needed the check. And then after I pulled my credit card out and left it there, he took another 15 or 20 minutes to come back before he ever took my payment. He was just, I don't know what he was doing. He was not anywhere to be found. He was completely gone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fine. I finally just threw my hands up and said, I left him zero. So, but I, that's very, very rare.
Yeah.
Very, very rare.
I struggle with this one just because I think.
I'd rather overtip.
Yeah. Sherry, I think you're accurate how it's set up in my limited experience in my travels in Europe where their salary is actually their salary. They're not reliant on the tip to live is the best way for it to be. But in general, I tend to not. You either do it right, do it good, or, you don't get a tip. But I will say I have tipped someone with bad service and the circumstances.
I have to.
I found out something about the person. So for example, in August, I was in Dallas for a business trip and a young woman picked me. I had to take an Uber from the airport down to our office. And this young woman did not know the area at all. She had been from a farther area out bringing a ride to the airport and thought she would just be picking. She was a new Uber driver. Thought she would just be picking someone else up to just go back home. And instead I was asking her to take me to downtown Dallas, which was farther away from where she was. She didn't know how to drive through. I thought we were going to die at one point. She didn't know how to drive through the airport. She got in some lane and then that wasn't the right lane. So she slams it in reverse and goes back about 500 feet at a really fast pace. And I was just like, know, saying a few prayers in the back seat. And, but then as we were talking and I got to know that she was a new Uber driver, that she wasn't familiar with the area. You know, found out that she was a, you know, had a large family, had extended family responsibilities and an elderly person that lived with her. And we were just chatting and, it was a mess of a ride, but and maybe it was a song and dance. I don't think it was, but I was like, this person is out here busting it, trying to make a living, for all these people that are dependent upon her. And so I did tip her. So that's where, where it's a conflict, you know? Yeah. That's where it's a conflict. Sometimes it's like, I don't want to tip this behavior, but she could use this.
Well, what about shame tipping? You know, where you're at, let's say McDonald's, and it has a place and they pass you that. I know they don't do this at McDonald's, so I'm just using it where it has a place to fill in the tip when it's just you've gone up to the counter.
No, that doesn't intimidate me at all. No, I have no problems not doing that.
I guess I haven't really experienced that in from the perspective of thinking it was shame tipping.
Well, they have like a little bucket too that say tips appreciated or whatever, you know, that.
But I have.
This is when they're showing you that form.
Yeah,
they're looking at you and they know what's on it.
They're standing there looking at you. Yeah, you got to give us anything or not.
Nope.
Well, I think if they're providing a service, I'm still going to tip them, but I don't let it impact how much. You know, I'm going to give them what I think I should give them.
Yeah.
We did have we went out to dinner one time in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and it took them an hour to take our order. And we knew we were in trouble at that point. It took about another hour to get our food. It was crazy. And we started complaining to the manager, obviously. And the manager's like, well, if you don't like your service, then just don't leave a tip. And I said, well, it's not my server's fault. Because it wasn't. They didn't have enough staff in the kitchen to make the food. So this isn't my server's fault. I'm going to tip my server. You need to comp the meal. ultimately they did. They covered the meal and I left a nice tip for the server because it wasn't her fault. But I don't know. Interesting question. Sherry, it has been a pleasure to actually speak with you in person, not just in email.
See you virtually, but see you.
Thank you for all your work on my books. And I especially appreciate your comments on my last one, Reckless Abandon. You gave me some very nice comments about it. And
listeners, I encourage you to check out Sherry's books.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
give
us the names of the two books again that you recommended they start with.
Well, I'd like you to do, I'm going to give you three.
Okay.
A Song for Her Enemies. Okay. A Song for Her Enemies. And then its sequel, What Hides Behind the Walls. But they're both standalone books. You don't have to read one to know the other one.
Okay.
Okay.
And the third one is one that just came out called Tricks and Treachery. And it's about my sister. I mean, it's based on my sister's story who got involved with scammers who took her money.
Oh, wow. Okay. And, interesting.
Yeah. So that one, that just came out. So that would be a good one, too. Need more people to read them.
Awesome.
There you go.
Just like you need more people to read your books.
Right.
That's we always need readers.
Yeah. We never have enough readers.
And readers will say they never have enough books. So it's always good to have these recommendations.
Right.
Okay. Okay, folks. Thank you very much for joining us on this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Sherry, thank you for being our guest today. Nancy, thank you for being my co-host. You're just the sweetest co-host in the world. And Bill White here, thank you for post-production work. And we will catch you next time on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.
The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. New episodes drop approximately twice a month. You can email Michael at authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Michael DeCamp is the author of two novels, Abandoned Hope, Cutter's Notch Book 1, and Nozomi's Battle, Cutter's Notch Book 2. A collection of short stories entitled Cutter's Notch Interludes, and one nonfiction Christian devotional book entitled Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. All books can be found on Amazon or ordered from your local bookseller. Please join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.